Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 899. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, just outside of Chicago. And I'm back in the Reform Forum headquarters, our studio. We really have a fun episode lined up today. We're going to be talking about a book that we published recently, Order in the Offices, the second edition, Essays Defining the Roles of Church Officers. And to do that, we have some contributors and the principal editor of the volume. Let me introduce to you first, we have on video, as you may see, we have Greg Reynolds, who is a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. He served as a church planter and pastor in New York and New Hampshire. He's also the editor presently and has been for a very long time of Ordained Servant, a journal for church officers, one of our two key publications in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church. And he's a contributor to this book, Order in the Offices. Welcome back, Greg. It's so good to see you. It's been some time since we've had you on the program. I apologize.
No, likewise. No, it's fun to be here. I enjoy these conversations, and you do have done a wonderful job. I couldn't believe the number. 800 and
yeah,
something.
899. Wow. By God's grace, yes. We've done an episode every Friday. I mean, we sometimes record ahead, of course, but we haven't missed a Friday since we started back in January 2008. I'm like the Cal Ripken of podcasts.
There you go. Faithfulness. I like it.
I don't know. I can't say they're all good, but we've done 899 in a row, so we're thankful for that. We also have with us, and I'm very excited to welcome, we've got him on the phone over Zoom. We have with us Mark Brown, who also is a minister in the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, a graduate of Geneva College and Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. And he planted in 1977 Westminster OPC in Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania, where he faithfully served as pastor for 40 years until he retired in 2017. But he's also the editor of our book, the first edition and also the second edition. Welcome, Mark. It's so good to have you with us today.
Well, thank you, Camden. It's really good to be with you and Greg. I'm excited to join in on this conversation.
Amen. Well, we're really glad to have you. I'm looking forward to talking about these things. Alan Strange wasn't able to make it for this particular conversation this time, but we're looking to get him on the program, talk about some of his work on Hodge, and he continues to develop that work and some other forthcoming publications. So look forward to that, everyone. If you haven't received a copy of the book, this is a beautiful copy, if I may say so. The team has done a tremendous job in getting this to print. So we've got an excellent cover design. We're very thankful for the typesetting, the printing, which was done at Sheridan Books out in Michigan, is really sound, and everything about it has turned out well. And I'm so glad that the production matches the content of the book. And so if you don't have one, get a copy. And I want to announce that we have a coupon code available for everyone who's listening. We're running a 25% off sale at reformedforum.org. If you use coupon code ORDER25, that's ORDER25. The coupon's going to be good for 1 week, beginning March 21st, 2025, all the way through March 28th. But you can also purchase the book from several partner booksellers. We're happy to work with Reformation Heritage Books. You can find them online at heritagebooks.org. Also Canon and Creed Reformed Books at ccrbooks.org. And then finally, for all of our Canadian brothers and sisters, we're big news for us. We've just working out a partnership and a deal with Reformed Book Services up in Canada. And you can find them at, as you guessed it, reformedbookservices.com. So very finally, it's time that we have a Canadian distribution. We're happy about that. So things are moving forward. A lot of good things going for the publications here at Reformed Forum, and I couldn't be happier not only to promote this book, Order in the Offices, but to be speaking with our editor and contributor today. Brothers, I'd want to just start off, and first off, I'm looking forward to sitting back and hearing the history and hearing some great stories about the first edition of this book. But I'll ask you first, Mark, if you just let us know a little bit about that first edition, which was, about 30 plus years ago. What was what were some of your thoughts, and what eventually led you to compiling all these contributions, of requesting new contributions, and then ultimately editing the first edition? What were some of the reasons?
Well, the background started with conflict on the session. I was a young pastor. We grew fast as a church. We had six elders within 3 or 4 years of starting, and the congregation was growing. A lot of young people, a diverse mix. This was not a Reformed area. And so we had people coming from all traditions, Catholic, Protestant alike, converted people. But problems developed on the session. I was naive. I came out of seminary without any clear views on office. The 2.5 sort of view was the naive working model. And I was teaching with the elders that there was a distinction between the pastor and the ruling elders. Mm-hmm. And half of the session, coming from fundamental type background, moved harder and harder in what I'd call a Plymouth Brethren direction, where they saw all elders and no ministers as the ideal or as the working model. And to summarize briefly at this point, then, I contacted Charlie Dennison, our church historian, and becoming a good friend at the time. And he encouraged me to research the subject of office and maybe put together a book with a variety of men helping me. And that's why it's an edited book rather than a single author book.
That's tremendous. This is really a book of some OPC lore, because I remember coming up in seminary, which would have been several years later. I started my studies at Westminster in 2007. But by then, you know, this book was a little bit harder to find, although it was talked about quite a bit whenever the subject came up. And so when we had opportunity at Reform Forum to consider publishing some new books, being able to pick this up and to bring a second edition into print is really significant, because there isn't a whole lot out there, at least in any single go-to volumes, that really address this particular issue. So for those of you who may be new to the subject or don't know exactly what order in the offices is all about, it's essentially advocating for a three-office view of Presbyterian church polity, particularly, that asserts that there are three distinct, biblically warranted special offices in the church today: minister, or pastor, we often say, then ruling elder, and deacon. So ministers, elders, and deacons as three distinct offices. This is, of course, rooted in the Westminster Standards, rooted in historic Presbyterianism, emphasizing the clear distinctions in the roles and functions of these offices. And this stands in contrast to a typical two-office view, which largely just views there being two offices of elder and deacon. And sometimes ministers are seen as a specialized form of elder. So we're going to unpack that. Some people may be scratching their head. Other people may already be geared up for a battle and listening. others may be interested to talk about the different views. I remember when I was even asking for people to endorse this book, many were very excited to do so. I remember from one friend, I received a polite response who said, "Well, brother, I'd really like to, but I'm a two-office guy. I don't know if I can endorse the book." I said, "I don't care, frankly. I mean, my point is I'm an advocate for the three-office view here. I'm happy to have this book in print. But even if you disagree with the view, this book has such value because it advocates and presents some of the best arguments all in one spot for the three-office view. So even if you are two-office or two-and-a-half-office, just having the book and reading it and becoming familiar with it is, in my opinion, essential. So I think somebody can even endorse a book that they disagree with, and that could be a good thing. But Greg, I want to ask you as well just about your knowledge and awareness of the subject and some of the background to your particular article. We can get into the specifics of it perhaps a little bit later, but you wrote a chapter on the on democracy and the denigration of office. But what were you seeing back in the 90s in terms of the church and some of the influences and effects that also were kind of leading to the need for such a book?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So back in the day, I was never two office. because even though I never heard too often strictly, though I've recently heard it from one of our ministers, but I knew that I just had questions from people joining the church, especially when people are new to the tradition. They go, oh, well, who's in charge here? And so they want to know about the authority structure. I even had one man say, I'm not submitting to anyone. I'm submitting to God. So they just, all of church government was out for them. But, you know, I picked up, even back in seminary, that our culture is pretty radically egalitarian. And we see this more and more rearing its ugly head. And egalitarianism, of course, is a perfect place for dictatorship to emerge. And so I, coming out of the counterculture of the 1960s, you know, I had dinner in Switzerland with Timothy Leary. So I was really into the counterculture in a philosophical way. And I was there at Labrie. I had become a Christian. And so it was very interesting to see how things changed for me, because in the counterculture, there's no authority structure. And so to me, Presbyterianism was just wonderful. And I went, wow, you know, this is what the Bible seems teaching. I had to do a lot of exegetical work to kind of flesh that out. But it stood out to me, Presbyterianism, as being really countercultural. And so I think ecclesiology, especially in the first 10 years of my ministry, was something that I did a lot of work in with the Puritans, with our standards and the history of Westminster, and the development of our confession and catechisms. And of course, it runs through our entire tradition. What's interesting to me and sad, which I mentioned in the article, is that 1941, what we had in our book referred to the minister's office as the first in dignity and usefulness. And I went, wow, that's a wonderful statement. But it's one of those things where I guess we're afraid that somehow we're going to be accused of elitism or something like that. But we watered that down, and I was very disappointed in that. And I would say that anyone who says they're to office in the OPC is contradicting their ordination vows. Now, they don't intend to do that, because the men that I know that have ever said that are godly, faithful men, and several of them are good friends. But 2.5 is always what I would hear from men, because they wanted to protect the ministry of the word. And there's really three offices. If you look at the early days of ordained servant, you see that there's an article that I only recently discovered where G.I. Williamson had changed his view from to office. And he said he went and read Thornwell, whom everyone would say, yeah, well, he was to office. And he said, no, he wasn't. He was really three office. It was some difference in terminology between him and Hodge. And they were different in a number of ways in their ecclesiology. But he changed his mind. And there was somebody else. Larry Wilson was another one, I believe, who had an article about how he changed from a more two-office view to a three-office view. But the pervasiveness of the democratic and egalitarian instinct is something that is a problem. It's been a problem in American culture since way back. If you look at the first and second, what Daryl Hart calls not so great awakenings,
or the pretty good awakening.
The first one was not so great, and the second was really not great at all. But it undermined authority. So many good, faithful, godly ministers were undermined in their ministries. And Whitfield was wonderful in many ways, but he was used by that egalitarian instinct, I think, to undermine authority structures in the New England church.
There's no doubt about it. That's really helpful. Greg's mentioned James Henley Thornwell, but as one key figure, and he is often presented as this opponent to the three-office view. But I'd like to back up, Mark, and ask you about some of your initial studies after you had been encouraged by Charles Denison to undertake this study and start thinking about maybe producing a resource on it. Who were some of your maybe go-to theologians? I guess, who were you reading at the time that was really most helpful to you in developing your theology of special office in the church?
Yeah, that's a good question, and maybe I can piggyback on some of Greg's first comments there to tie some things together. I was a Banner of Truth man from my college days, and bought every book they published, and went to the conferences, met the leaders. Was Al Martin and Walt Chantry were great models for me of preaching. Ian Murray, the great biographer of so many people, an article of his on ruling elders and the controversy related to them in the Banner magazine came across my path as these troubles were brewing in our local church. And in reading that article, I saw I was not alone, that this has been the ruling elder and minister question has been a difficulty from at least the last two centuries. And he keyed me in with, everybody knows in our circles, Charles Hodge, and his book on church polity was not published in the 20th century. And the articles on ecclesiology were separate from his three-volume systematic theology that they used at Princeton and Westminster. So people weren't aware of Hodge's views on office. The other fellow mentioned by Ian Murray was Thomas Smythe, a Southern Presbyterian contemporary of Hodge. Well, I happened to study at Gettysburg Lutheran Seminary for my retreats. It's 2 hours away, and I'm a Civil War buff. And they happened to have the 10-volume works of Thomas Smythe. So every retreat, every time I would get there, I would delve into to Smythe. And he was voluminous. He wrote without editing, and so it's a little hard to read his things. But Thomas Smythe then and his co-worker Hodge got me back on the historic reform path. Now, one other quick thing I would say, the tie to Greg here is talking about democracy. Without getting into politics, you know, the last year or so, there's been this big push on saving our democracy, which always bugged me because I thought we were a republic as a nation. And Mike, one of his first books was called Ecclesiastical Republicanism, where he said the Presbyterian Church is an ecclesiastical republic with ruling elders as the lay representatives of the people. And just as a neat illustration, when we were visiting the Woodrow Wilson Boyhood Home in Stanton, Virginia, the other year, his dad was a minister, and they had his library or some books there, and I could squint and see Smythe's book, Ecclesiastical Republicanism, was one of his titles. So that was a neat time.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. And that has a lot of applicability. And it's not just, of course, it's not the fact that Presbyterians are taking their cue from, the founding fathers of the United States of America. It's quite the opposite in terms of the influence. So for those who may be wondering how, the flow of that influence, it goes from Presbyterianism down to what we have today, but that might help as an illustration.
There is a great Bettner quote, Dr. Bettner of Reformed Doctor of Predestination. That's the book we cut our teeth on here. It's a new mission. I didn't start in the shallow waters with the folks here. We dug right into predestination, but his quote on this subject was, Calvin is the real founder of the American Republic. So that makes your point that Presbytery came first and the politics came second.
Thank you. I'd like for you, Mark, and of course, Greg, pitch in as you feel and as you'd like. But Mark, I'm wondering if you, just as we continue this introductory line of discussion, if for our listeners and viewers, if you can maybe sketch out some of the basic arguments. I know that this is we have a very large book and an important book that details all this from soup to nuts, but at least for people who might not be familiar with the contours of the debate, I'm wondering if you might be able to at least express some of the principal reasons why you advocate for a three-office view or a very clear distinction between ministers and ruling elders.
Basically, to defend both offices. One of the principles of the three-office view is that office is not New Testament Christianity, that it's rooted in the Old Covenant structure. So there is a continuity of offices. So elders of the people in the Old Covenant are morphed into the ruling elders of the New Covenant. The priests, teachers, rabbis of the Old Covenant morphed into the apostles and their successors, the ministers of the word, in the New Covenant. And sometimes people criticize the three-office view and say, oh, you just look down on ruling elders. And the answer is really the opposite to that. We respect godly, wise, and respected men respected by the congregation as the ruling elders of our tradition. If you don't keep the offices separate, you have clericalism. You have one group, not two. You have one group that basically can become an oligarchy and in running the church. And it's just a shame. The tension comes when those offices are confounded. Some of the best ruling elders I've seen in the OPC, and I don't want to name names to embarrass anybody, but are the men who understand their calling. And some of the most difficult men over the years at Assembly and in our session here and in Presbytery are the men who want to be co-pastors, part-time pastors, see themselves as the pastors of the church when they're calling. They don't have the gifts, the training, the education, the ordination for that. And that's where the strife, the arrogance, the envy, and that comes into, not just our session, but when this book came out or was coming out, you would be amazed the number of pastors across the country that had great tribulation, not with their whole session, but often with just one or two men who did not respect the offices.
It's important, you know, Greg, I'm sure you could pitch in on this idea, but again, that when we're speaking of special office, we're not talking about some sort of inherent worth or value that some people are more important or better than others. We're talking about giftedness and the Lord's calling to equip and call certain people to certain tasks within the church. And everyone holds a general office of believer, every Christian. But each person is, as Peter says, received a unique measure of God's varied grace to carry out whatever the Lord has set before them to do. You know, we've been created for good works so that we would walk in them. Even before the foundation of the earth, the Lord has had this planned. And that includes also special office and a special grace, so to speak, a special giftedness to do certain functions at certain times. Greg, have you found similar strife where people have misunderstood at least the motives of the three-office view?
Oh, yes. I think Mark and I would share this, although I was very, in all of my church planting, I've had wonderful sessions overseeing the work because it's difficult to begin with. And if you have to plant it,
right,
and you have this egalitarianism in the leadership, you have serious trouble. But yeah, I've had several in elders in the past in the church, in churches that I planted, that really did, they diminished the teaching office as if, well, this is easy. I mean, what you're doing is fairly easy. And when they then tried to do it, they realized that it's actually not easy. It's different. It's quite difficult.
Yeah.
And in fact, I sometimes look back and wonder how I ever produced Sunday school, adult Sunday school, and two sermons every single Sunday.
Oh, I know.
Or 48 or 47, whatever it is, weeks a year.
Yeah.
And it's a giftedness. And as you say, it has nothing to do with, I mean, we need to have moral purity,
mm-hmm.
But we're also sinners. And mm-hmm. So in every way, in terms of our humanity, we are like everyone else, ruling mm-hmm. elders, deacons, and every member of the church. But on the other hand, the Lord has gifted us an office so that we would say we respect the office because of what God has called us to do. And especially with the three office view, it protects the ministry of the word. And the ministry of the word is precious. And if everyone is a governor or focuses on all the different work in the church, the pastor will not have enough time to focus on the preaching of the word. And I think in Brethrenism, you see an extreme example of this because everyone gets up, every male in the congregation has the right to get up and exhort the congregation. And that's a mixed blessing. I've sat in a few Brethren assemblies, and there was clearly in one instance in Concord way back in the 70s, there was one man who was definitely gifted to teach. And this man spent dozens of hours every week in the word. He was teaching. I wish he'd been gone to seminary. Wonderful man. But that kind of egalitarianism really undermined the ministry of the word, because some very foolish and ill-prepared things were said in that particular assembly. So I also, in one of the things that I've said, just practically speaking, after going through 3 years of seminary, and at Westminster, it was the most intellectually demanding seminary, at least in the United States, and then going through all the examinations for licensure and then ordination, it's like, do you really think this is the same as a ruling elder? And so to be consistent, if you're to office, everyone needs to have a seminary degree and, by the way, a liberal education, or nobody needs to have that. And of course, none of my friends who say they're 2.5 office would ever agree to that. So they're actually three. Why do they like to use that term? I believe, because I've known a number of wonderful ministers who have called it a 2.5 office view, is they're trying to be humble. And that's, of course, an important thing for us all to work at, at being. And so I think there's that dimension. On the other hand, some of them have actually experienced, this is both ministers and but elders particularly, men who've said they're three office and have lorded it over their session as if
it's terrible.
The word is the only way, a my way or the highway kind of mentality.
Yeah, there's so much to say there. It's interesting, and I think one question that I've raised when I've had conversations on this issue, if for no other reason than just to come at it from an angle or to get people thinking. So even people who are two office, or even if they might cheekily say they're 2.5, one question is: let's say you have a ruling elder in Nay Park churches. You know, that ruling elder is typically not going to or not allowed to administer the sacraments. Probably can't give a benediction, and it's certainly not in the OPC. If such person maybe goes to seminary or wants further studies and wants to do and feels called to do those things, would you reordain them, or would you have another ordination service? And the answer to that is yes. The people, if you have a ruling elder to become a minister, they would have a service and ordain that person to that office. If it's not a different office, and I kind of wonder why would you do another ordination? But even the books for the 2.5 office types, even the book seems to reveal that it really isn't function often a three office view.
Right. And what men are ordained to is not to some vague amorphous eldership. But to an office. And the OPC Book of Order has three discrete offices that you're ordained to. And you're right on that. And I appreciate Greg's point there on pastor abusers. Who are dominating, domineering, and give a bad name to the three office view, but the 2.5 and two office views have that as well. But
indeed, that perhaps touches on an important matter, because some of the questions arise when there are certain New Testament passages. Now, we can talk about specific passages and specific interpretations, because there's debate and discussion about how to interpret some of these key passages as well. But in several popular interpretations of some key passages on office, it seems as if the office of minister and the office of ruling elder are sometimes the same word is used to describe, or at least they're described as jointly ruling or governing. And that can lead to some further maybe confusion, but it also adds some fuel to the fire in terms of understanding. Mark, I'm wondering if you can speak perhaps about the ways in which the New Testament speaks about these three continuing special offices in the church, and maybe suggest some better ways for us to understand those relations.
Well, I think when you come out of a two or a two and a half office mentality, you are reading the word presbyter or its English translation elder. And in your mind, you equate that with the ruling elder of the church. And that's just historically, and I'd say biblically, inaccurate. The ruling elder is a presbyter in the same way that the minister is, or the apostle is, a deacon, in a generic or a general sense. Not always is it used in the sense of office. Let's take the pastorals. I coined the term, they are not called the elder alls. And there's a reason for that. Historically, those 1 Timothy 3, for example, the qualifications there for the overseer or bishop, translated pastor in some other conservative translations, the focus is on the pastor or the minister of the word. Smythe has a great quote. He says, preaching and preachers, not ruling and rulers, is the focus of the New Testament. The ruling elder is not the essential officer, the basic officer. It's a second, not being diminutive at all, but it's a secondary office. There is order to the offices. The Christian Reform sometimes want to say the offices are all on an equal plane, but I read 1 Corinthians 12 and other passages, that Ephesians 4, there is a listing or an order to the offices, and that's where the title of our book also even comes from, order in the offices. So to me, the focus of generic Presbyterianism, what I call generic or Catholic Presbyterianism, is that the presbyter, bishop, pastor, teacher of our tradition is equal to the minister, pastor, preacher in the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church, the Lutheran Church. There's a common understanding of that focus on the ministry of the word as the primary New Testament officer, the successor to the apostles.
Mm. Greg, in your chapter, again, your essay here is titled Democracy and the Denigration of Office. You're on point here with some of these themes, because in that essay, you're tackling the cultural pressures against hierarchical church structures. One of those pressures in the 90s, and it's still around, is the shift toward every member ministry. And I'm wondering what you think about that. Have things shifted? Have they evolved? What are some pressures that we might experience in the church today? And to what extent are they similar to what you were experiencing, what we all were experiencing in the 1990s? Or as my son now, I have a teenager now, and he referred to the 90s as the late 1900s. So I'm
so that's right. I was born in the last century. That,
yes, exactly.
Yeah, I would say it's simply gotten worse, and so the egalitarian instinct is just everywhere. I had a very interesting encounter with someone who now went to be with the Lord in the last 5 years. But when he came out of a Baptist background, became Reformed in his soteriology, maintained his Baptist view of ecclesiology and baptism. And when he came to his first congregational meeting, which the Dover work was then a mission of Amoskeg Presbyterian Church. So some of the people would come over for the annual meeting, which was good. And this gentleman came up to me afterwards, and he said, I thought I had said something during the meeting that sparked his interest. And he said, I thought we were a democracy. And so it was great. Fortunately, he was very bright and very receptive to listening to the argument that no, we're not a democracy. And in fact, as Mark pointed out earlier, we're really we're a constitutional republic, both nationally we are, but biblically we are in terms of being Presbyterian. So we're not. We have a hierarchy. There's a structure of authority that God has given to us, and the world now more than ever pushes against that. We're so what is the word that that Carl Truman uses? It's it's not experiential individualism. I call it radical individualism.
Sure.
And that's what we have, where I'm the ultimate authority, and who are you to tell me anything? I'll be willing to speak up very strongly about my views, and you'd better listen to me. But I don't need to listen to you. So that kind of egalitarianism is there in spades now. So what I planted four churches over my ministry by God's grace, and with much help from other officers in the church. And at the very outset, I have made it plain, because I want people to know that we have this view of the authority structure of the church, and it's inherently Presbyterian. It's what we are when it comes to a biblical authority, so that then they won't come back later and say, oh, I didn't understand that we were submitting to elders and to the minister of the word. And so at the very beginning, I always instill this in every single meeting that we had. There's a session, and when it was just a session gathered from the presbytery while we were mission work, this is where policy is set, times of worship and all kinds of other things. We will, for very important things, we'll get together and have you ask questions and give your points of view, because we're ministering to be a blessing to you. But while we're doing that, we have the authority, once we've heard you, to come up with policy that will be the best for the whole body, and particularly policy that's rooted in the truth of Scripture.
Mm. I'm finding some strange things in evangelicalism. I guess they've always been there. But my kids attend a conservative but an evangelical school nearby. My wife works there. We're very thankful. It's been a good influence on us, and our kids are growing and thriving. But by nature of the school, there are people from a variety of different churches that send their kids and that attend. And sometimes, even in the application to become a student, there's a form about, are you a member of a church, what church, that sort of thing. And my wife, who works in admissions, has found that there are churches sometimes in the area that say they don't do membership. That's how they put it. Literally, you can't be a member of the church. They don't, let alone not have an office, so to speak, but they don't even have membership. So this is where things have headed here in the 2020s.
No, that's absolutely true. And I have found this. That's why I wrote an article years ago about the biblical basis for church membership.
Mm-hmm.
I had someone here who came out of a charismatic background, a lovely woman in every way, but she believed that it was unspiritual to require membership mm-hmm. in the church. So I gave her the article and said, please read the article, because I think you're wrong on this topic, and you're actually imbibing the spirit of the world, not the spirit of Scripture. And but she never actually did join the church.
Well,
I think we've all had that difficulty. I wrote an article also early in my ministry on 10 reasons for church membership. It was in New Horizons magazine a couple times. But this area, Central PA, I don't know if it was Jerry Falwell or who called Central Pennsylvania the northern buckle of the Bible Belt. And that was one of the key things that we had to stand in contrast against, was a fundamentalism that had a lot of Plymouth Brethren influence, that membership was not only not important, but not necessary. And it was hard to, it took a lot of praying and pleading with people to see the necessity of being part of part of the church.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, recently, Camden, this just came to mind in light of your question. I had lunch with someone who I've been following their ministry over the years, and they are Anglican. in background training, went to Oxford. And so they really imbibed the English ecclesiology, the Anglican Church. And they became a pastor of a congregational church, a very prominent one, actually. And I asked him, I said, what's it like making this transition? And so he went to the meeting of the Four Cs, which I actually pastored a church in the Four Cs and got them to come out of the United Church of Christ. And they didn't want to become Presbyterian, so they went into the Four Cs. But apart from believing that the Bible is the Word of God and Jesus Christ is the only Savior of sinners, and that there's such a thing as the Trinity, there's a very loose group of evangelicals. And so when he went to the first meeting, I said, well, what was that like? And he said, oh, it was great. You know, everyone was so nice, and I got to meet all these different people. He said, but there was no structure. And he said, that was very disconcerting to me. And of course, as an Anglican, you've got kind of the opposite. You know who's in charge, and everyone knows what their role is. And he said, here, no one was in charge, really, and no one knew what their role was. So it was a very thing to see that that contrast.
Yeah, certainly. And you know, that might sound neat to him for a moment, but could down the road lead to all sorts of different issues. That's the beauty of Presbyterian governments, that it's neither top down and hierarchical in that sense, and neither is it just purely congregational or atomistic. But it's truly, you have parity, plurality, and connectedness, the three real core principles of Presbyterianism, which is so refreshing. Greg, I've been using I haven't taught the new members class for a while since I transitioned to work full-time at Reform Forum, but for ages I was using the Making a Good Confession materials that you were editing, and I love that. So I know exactly what you're talking about, not only as doing something similar to what you're doing and have done with new members, but actually using your specific resources on that, which have been very helpful. So it's important to talk about that stuff.
Publish that, actually. One of the things that I found too, Camden, is that if you're really serious about our structure of the local church, especially the session, it's going to humble you. Mm-hmm. And I just, when I look at the way the best men that I've worked with, and I've worked with the majority of the sessions that I've been part of, have been just wonderful men with a wonderful variety of gifts. And we just worked, we got together just wonderfully. And they kept me from doing some foolish things. You know, they kept me, they took bad ideas and showed that they were not good, or they took good ideas that needed all kinds of refining to put into practice.
Yeah.
And not to work as just all on your own, to me, is a very foolish thing. And it's one of the geniuses of the biblical order of offices.
I'd love to talk more about some of the effects of not getting this right, and to pick back up with some more practical application for our contemporary era. But I don't want to run out of time before I can ask Mark about the forgotten Thomas Smythe. That's chapter 5 in this book, starting on page 79. Mark, you already mentioned about the presence of one of his key books in Reverend Wilson's library. So I'd like to think that that's had some sort of influence more broadly than that. But if he's a forgotten Thomas Smythe, tell us a bit about how you were introduced to him, and maybe some of his key contributions, even in maybe some of these 19th century debates with Thornwell.
Well, I think he wrote voluminously. I said 10 volumes of work, but volume 4, if anyone wants to research him, that is the key. There's several different series of essays and even books within volume 4 of his completed works. I lived with him for probably about a decade with
reading
and publishing some of his essays in the old-fashioned photocopy form for people and things. He just had a clarity and an understanding that you needed to distinguish the offices to provide peace and unity in the church. If I can jump to Clowney for a minute, Dr. Clowney has a tremendous biblical theological article in the book that he allowed me to include. And for many people, it's their favorite article in the book. He makes the point that the gift of rule is a gift that people can have without being a teacher. The 2 and 2.5 office people often want to have everybody a teacher in the church. And I've heard even recently where pastors sometimes trying to get new elders for the church tell them, you have to be apt to teach. Well, apt to teach in the Bible is not the ability to speak and address a Sunday school class. It involves the whole host of preaching and preparation matters. And what Connolly does is allow for rulers, and that's where the three office view, I think the genius of it is, you get men involved in the rule and government of the church who are not the pastor preachers of the church. And that's what makes Presbyterianism go. You know, in the Congregational and Baptist churches, they had ruling elders in their genesis, but they died out. And they died out. The reason, I think it's Williston Walker, their classic historian, said the reason they died out is that they were required to do all the things ministers were to do, except preaching. They didn't get the fun task of preaching and having the public acclaim of the of the people, but they had to do all the dirty work that the minister didn't want to do, and they died out. And Presbyterianism allows for a pastor preacher and a ruler governor both. And I guess that's one of the key points of Smythe. He I ended my article with one of his sarcastic quotes about how to require ruling elders to be teachers, apt to teach, with the care of souls, without being adapted and trained to teach, is like sending volunteers to fight without discipline or arms. He said, ought not ruling elders to be very thankful that we are defending them from the imposition of clerical titles, office duties, and responsibilities? Who among them could endure to be clothed with the pastoral office without education, fitness, desire, or opportunity for it, without, in short, a call to the ministry? So that's his one of his concluding statements. And again, for anybody who wants to research beyond the article, Smythe has two classic sets of theories of the eldership, sets of essays that are well worth the wordiness and digging into.
Tremendous. Yeah, that's really helpful. There's a lot to read on Smythe, but even this essay, The Forgotten Time of Smythe, having all those footnotes is valuable, some excerpts. There's great emphasis on how Smith believed that the New Testament offices were rooted in and flow from the Old Testament offices. Another introductory volume on this is by one of the endorsers of this volume, by Cornelis Van Damme. We interviewed him years ago on this subject, and he's written a book called The Elder. He's also written a book called The Deacon. So if you're looking for those, they're very, very helpful. But also Smith is really useful in presenting and connecting, well, at least explaining the theology and the form of government in the Westminster standards. So that's helpful on that front. Really, really quite useful. To pick back up where we were also talking about the effects of this book, the influence of this book, and the value, perhaps, of this book. There are two, well, really 1.5. Is this, am I vacillating between a 1 article and a 2 article view now? Because there's like 1.5 new articles or new essays in this book. Alan Strange's article is a new contribution. But Greg, if I'm not mistaken, what we've included in this, what Mark has included here and suggested that we include, is an expansion and or adaptation of what was originally in the first edition, but something that was published, perhaps, was it in New Horizons or Ordained Servant? What's the background to that?
Well, I had published, you mean my article?
Yes, 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 yes.
It's, I republished it, I think twice over the 20 years that I've been editor servant, and it really didn't change very much.
Oh, I mean, I see.
There were some
I got you.
I saw some things, you know, as an editor, I annoy people on a regular basis about things like Oxford commas and trivia. So there were a lot of that, but there, it's essentially is the same, is the same as I did want to bring up one thing that back in 1987, Kevin Reed and I, Kevin actually had a little publishing company called Presbyterian Heritage Publications, and published a lovely little hardcover edition of The Ruling Elder by Samuel Miller.
Oh.
Now, he's interesting because he was three office, and yet he used the list of attributes and gifts in 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 as to teach, to train both ruling elders and ministers. So I have used that as well, even though my inclination is very strongly with Smythe and Calvin that the governor, mention of governors is where you really, from what, First Corinthians 12 and Romans 12, that's where you get your foundation. But I found it useful to do that. But we always came to a point of, well, apt to teach, what does that mean? And so what I would say to the ruling elder is apt to teach for you is going to mean that you're able to explain if someone asks you about a doctrine or a practice in the Christian life that you can go and open scripture with them and explain it to them. But I definitely, and so that was Miller diverged from the tradition, I think, in that regard. But I'm definitely inclined to believe that exegetically that Smythe and Calvin had the more accurate view.
I'm thinking about some ways to encourage the people. Of course, I want people to read this book and to be familiar with the arguments and to search and study the scriptures and follow the arguments in the book to help you in that regard. But for both of you, I guess I'll start with Mark. I'm wondering if you have any wise counsel to offer pastors and church leaders who are indeed seeking to uphold the three office model as a biblical model in today's climate. Do you have any suggestions or any thoughts for pastors today and how you might encourage them to maybe implement some more biblical practices within their congregations?
Well, I think first they need to understand it clearly themselves, because I don't think seminaries as a whole teach the subject.
Why do you think that's the case? That begs the question. Why do you think that that's the case? Because I feel that we barely touched on this sort of thing when I was in seminary as well. Why? I guess that's a bigger question. Do you have any thoughts on it?
I do. That is an interesting question, because like Greg, I'm not sure. Did you go to Westminster as well, Camden?
Yes, I did, in Philadelphia.
Okay. And Westminster, yeah, me too. And great school, very academic, but even in my day, it was even more so scholars preparing academic for academic preparation. It wasn't pastors teaching pastors. Most of the men did not have a lot of or much at all in the way of pastoral experience out in the trenches. And so the subject of a pastor and his elders dealing with each other's qualifications and functions just didn't really come up. In the OPC, you look at our founding fathers, they came out of the Northern Church and they were all naively pre-office. They just had absorbed that. And you see the manuals for ruling elders and where they clearly make the differences. Machen and the early faculty and that, they just assumed a three-office view. So when it wasn't taught over the generations, the two-office view coming out of Baptist fundamentalism and out of Plymouth Brethrenism, and Greg's great point on egalitarianism of the society, the two-office view just came into a vacuum. That's all people knew about. And so I think pastors need to, I would say, read through order in the offices and read through the book of order of their denomination and gradually implement clarity in those matters with their ruling elders and with congregations.
Greg, you also serve on our Committee for Christian Education, and you edit a magazine titled, or a journal titled, Ordained Servant. So, I mean, you're also very interested and have been involved heavily in even educating people about these matters. And I know that through MTI, or the Ministerial Training Institute, just primarily looking at ministers, but also elders as well, there've been a lot of efforts over the last couple of decades to maybe supplement, we might even say augment, some of these things, at least within the Orthodox Presbyterian Church, but that's not a privilege that every denomination has.
No, that's correct. In fact, both Ordained Servant and MTI, which is us, a part of the Christian Ed Committee. So we have two subcommittees on ministerial training and then resources for the churches. But MTI teaches particularly things that you're not going to get in seminary. And I think one of them is to teach the proper view of the offices. And then I cover that, of course, in Ordained Servant, and there are many articles. I try to give, I go to the archives at the end of each editor's introduction in order to get people to see how much rich material we have in the archives. There's pretty much not a question among elders, deacons, and ministers that you won't find an answer to in our archives. But one of the things that I would suggest, so that's for training elders and ministers and deacons to understand the three office view. But I think that it's important for ministers to teach this in a clear, simple way at the beginning or during all congregational meetings. I mean, you can't go into it, maybe take too much time, but explaining, and I did this, as I said earlier, in all of my church planting experience, and it ended up being kind of an inoculation against future trouble. If you continue to teach people these things, then they're going to understand that this is the kind of church that they have joined or are joining. So I always, from using the membership booklet, that I go over these things so people know exactly what they're getting into, and hopefully they feel that it's biblical and wonderful.
Yeah, I found that in my experience, most people, when it's explained well and explained and taught from the scriptures, because that's where it's based, I found people are typically, in our context, people that are coming from other evangelical contexts or even, you know, Roman Catholic backgrounds, they love it. I mean, they're very receiving of Presbyterianism. Typically, the times when you find people hating Presbyterianism is when our fifth membership vow comes into effect, where it's like, you know, you vow to submit to the government of this church, even in which case you're found delinquent, you know, in doctrine or life. It's when we end up with situations of discipline needing to be addressed that you find people suddenly no longer Presbyterians. But
right. Oh, you forgot that you took that vow.
Exactly.
Yeah, convenient amnesia.
Yeah, exactly. And that's true for everybody. I mean, ministers, you see that sadly when they fall off and renounce the jurisdiction or do sorts of things like that, which are really, really horrible. But the Lord is gracious to his people, and we trust that his provision for the church and the structure that he puts into place is more than sufficient to accomplish his purposes and his ends by his power. That's great. Do either of you, especially you, Mark, have any final thoughts or words or encouragement or things that you'd like to talk about before we maybe conclude our conversation for today?
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to share a bit of the background and genesis of the book, and some of the reasons why it developed in the heat of church life and conflict. I think I would just encourage people not to be biblicists and to reject Plymouth Brethrenism and all its egalitarianism, and realize, study the great commentators, and don't just read the Bible in English and assume you know what it says. One quick example would be Acts 20, where Paul calls for the elders of the church. you can read that as a biblicist naively and say, well, that must have been the session of Ephesus.
Mm-hmm.
But as R.C. Sproul points out so well in his new sermon commentary on Acts, those were the teaching elders of the congregations of the Presbytery of Ephesus, because they were to feed the church with the word of God, the apostolic pastoral ministry task. And again, that just a naive reading of scripture can lead you to a two office view. You need to be a little more careful, a little more humble, a little more history humbles everybody. The right. more you know, the more humble you are. And I just say, read on.
I love that. Yeah, we certainly hold to sola scriptura and the ultimate authority of scripture, but we also believe that we read that in light of the history of the church, and that God has been revealing his word to his people and blessing them with the Spirit through the ages. We don't read in isolation. That's not what we need to do. That's the problem of biblicism often. Greg, do you have any further thoughts or encouragement for us?
Well, I really liked what you just said, Mark, about not reading the Bible naively and having a biblicistic viewpoint. And isn't that the reason why we had to go yeah. through the agony of Greek and Hebrew and things that we learned about what, and then you do it in the context of the history of the church.
Right.
And it makes all the difference. I think just gently teaching these things to the people and to our officers, and showing a kind of humility in doing all of that in our leadership that will never allow them to come and say that the three office view is a kind of elitism, but no. It's rooted in the way God has, I always refer to it as God's authority structure. It's not something I made up. It's his structure, and we can show you from the word how that is the case.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both, brothers. It's been a pleasure to speak with both of you. I feel like we only scratched the surface, but no doubt we'll revisit and get into some other topics further on down the road. But Greg and Mark, it's been a pleasure. Thanks for joining me today. We appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome, Camden.
Thank you, Camden, for your leadership.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for your tremendous service. I'm glad and feel privileged and honored that Reform Forum was able to work with you and to get this out into print once again. I'm holding the book up for those of you listening, but if you're watching, you can see a picture of it, a wonderful hardcover. We've been talking today about Order in the Offices, Second Edition, Essays Defining the Roles of Church Officers, published by Reform Forum here, and it's edited by our guest today, Mark Brown, also with contributions by Mark and a contribution by Greg Reynolds and many other people that you'd be interested in, people of the past and also contemporaries. It's a wonderful book. We encourage you to get it. Finally, I encourage you to use perhaps our coupon code. You can save 25% off the book by using coupon code ORDER25. That's ORDER and the numbers 25. That's going to be good from March 21st through March 28th, 2025. But you can also find it over at Reformation Heritage Books, Canon and Creed Reformed Books, and in Canada at Reformed Book Services. And I'll try to include links to all those in the episode description. I do want to thank everybody for watching and for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.